But tonight we seek to cover Job 3. Now, the big structure of the book of Job, in Job 1 and 2, we have the prologue. That is the easiest part to understand, that along with the epilogue in chapter 42, verses 7 through 17. And that's the part of the book of Job that you hear the most about and that you're most familiar with. Chapters 3 through about 42, verse 6, are largely set in poetry. They are set in poetry. This is more difficult to understand, but this is all central to the book. Chapter 3, in a way, stands alone. Chapters 4 through 14 will start a dialogue between Job and his friends. And there are going to be three rounds of dialogue. 4 through 14 will be the first section. But in chapter 3, Job regrets that he was ever born. And the order is logical, even though the request may not be in some ways. In verses 1 through 10, Job is going to curse the day of his birth. In verses 11 through 19, Job will ask, "Why did I not die at birth?" He curses the day of his birth. He asks why he didn't die at birth in verses 11 through 19. And then in verses 20 through 26, why is light still given to him who suffers? Why is the person that finds life miserable and death something to be longed for? Why are they given life? It is a profound chapter. One writer spoke of it as one of the most depressing chapters of the Bible. But I think that depends on your perspective. I totally understand that estimation, that it's one of the most depressing chapters. But I also understand that, just like I preach on Psalm 88 sometimes, and one response that I've seriously gotten to preaching on that psalm, which is darkness all day long, is that was encouraging. Why? I think people might think it's encouraging because they can identify with it in all Job's pain. But I'm going to read from the New American Standard, in Job 3, verses 1 through 10. Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, or some of your translations may have, Job answered, verse 3, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night which said a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let the night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Let the stars of the twilight, be darkened. Let it wait for light, but have none. Neither let it see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb, or hide me from, or hide trouble from my eyes." So, Job opened his mouth. Now that sometimes is used, particularly in the New Testament, for a profound type of utterance. For example, that's the way Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is introduced in Matthew 5:2. That's the way Philip preaching Jesus to the eunuch is described in Acts 8, verse 35. That's the way Peter's statement at the house of Cornelius is introduced, where he opened his mouth and said, "I perceive that God is no respecter of persons." Sometimes this is the introduction to a particularly profound statement. But Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Now, as we have gone through the prologue, we have seen that Job feared his sons might curse God in their hearts. 1:5. The Satan says he will curse you to your face in 1:11 and in 2:5. But we saw that the word that was used there for curse is actually a word that means bless. That it's a euphemism, I'll just say it close and go on like I got it right. A euphemism. And it is a euphemism for a less offensive term. Here, it is a different word for curse than was used in the Hebrew text of Job 1 and 2. This word curse means curse. It is the word used when Abraham was told, "I will bless those who bless you, I will curse those who curse you," in Genesis 12 and verse 3. Or when we were forbidden to curse God or the king in Exodus 22 and verse 28. Job does not curse God. Job does not even curse his parents. But he curses the fact that he was ever born. Now in a moment, we're going to look a little bit at Jeremiah 20 after we finish verses 1 through 10. In Jeremiah 20, Jeremiah will say the same thing, utter the same kind of words that Job did. He will curse the day of his birth. The New International Version simply translates verse 2. He said. What's the significance of that? Well, it is the shortest verse in the NIV Bible. I don't know if there's anything greatly significant about that, but I just thought I'd share that with you. And the actual word for said is the word answered. But we generally think of the term answered being uttered to talk about a response to something, don't we? But it's not the way in Job. It will often be given just to start a speech. This is just a way basically to say that he said. But you notice, and this is going to be very repetitive, if you have trouble sometimes getting your arms around poetry because it just keeps seeming to pounding on the same point, and it does at times. It keeps kind of coming at something and ending up in the same direction. It is repetitive as he is going to pronounce a curse. Notice in verse 3, on the day he was born, and in verse 3, on the night in which he was conceived. Now, if you look at the language in chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, the day will be mentioned. In verses 6 through 9, the night will be mentioned. He curses the day of his birth, the night of his conception, and then in verse 10, he will state the reason why he curses them. We know that conception happens before birth. Notice they are introduced here in reverse order. Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night which said a boy is conceived. One writer said these particular words are used together 81 times in the Old Testament. And always, in those other instances, conception precedes birth. But here, poetically, they are used in parallelism. They're used in parallelism. Now, I recognize that many people, before they have children today, have an ultrasound and they know the sex of the child. I am just assuming that that did not exist in Job's day, okay? Just assuming that. But even with our ultrasounds of today, you can't tell it on the night of conception. So notice there is kind of hyperbole here as the text emphasizes, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night which said a boy is conceived. How could they tell the sex of the child on the night of conception? No way. It's just, again, what poetry sometimes loses in exactness, it is going to make up for in emotional effect. And this is a passage which is deeply emotional. And the text says in verse 4, may that day be darkness, and let not God above care for it, nor light shine upon it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the Spirit of God moved upon the waters, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. The word for darkness in Genesis 1 and verse 2 is the same word used here in Job 3 verse 4. God created light to shine, to enlighten the darkness, to dispel the darkness. But here Job prays that darkness will overwhelm that day of its birth and in effect make it like it never existed. Now, the word, there are five different Hebrew words for darkness in verses 4 through 6. Darkness truly engulfs this particular passage. Five different Hebrew words for darkness in verses 4 through 6. And the text is emphasizing, oh, that night simply, or that day, simply be covered with darkness as if it never happened. Does Job actually believe this curse accomplishes anything? Can we change history by pronouncing a curse, something that's already happened? But there's some times where we simply need to vent our frustrations. It's not that it accomplishes anything. It's not that it can rewrite history. It's not that it can use an eraser and make us disappear from the human story. Sometimes we simply need to vent. And probably we've all experienced that. But instead of darkness becoming light. Job is praying that the light become darkness, and that God not, that God above, the God who is so much greater than us, not care for it or seek it, the ESV has. The word seek there is actually more literal. God, don't be the good shepherd and go after this day. Don't seek it. Just let it disappear. Let it disappear. And in verse 5, let darkness and black gloom claim it. This is the New American Standard rendering at the first of verse 5. Now, a lot of other translations, and probably a lot of your translations that are represented here, will have the term shadow of death. Shadow of death. This is the same word used in Psalm 23 and verse 4. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Shadow of death. Now, that particular Hebrew word, and there's questions, a lot of people debate about how best is it really translated. But this word is used 18 times in the Old Testament. 10 of those times are in the book of Job. There is no biblical character who walks through the valley of the shadow of death quite like Job does. 10 of the 18 uses of this word appear in this book. Let darkness and black gloom or the shadow of death claim it. Actually, that word is a word that's almost always, if not always, used positively. The word claim it is actually the word redeem. But here, he's asking that darkness redeem that day and make it disappear. I don't mean to get lost in the words too much, because I think we see the basic idea of let a cloud settle on it, let blackness and day terrify it. All the things that we associate with darkness, like terror, we're more likely to become deeply afraid in the night than in the darkness. It is one thing to hear a loud sound at 4 in the afternoon and to look out and be able to see that nothing's going on, but it's another thing maybe at 4 a.m. if you're not awake to hear it, because darkness can terrify us. And Job uses all these kind of words to speak of the day that he was born. And then in verse 6, he begins to stress the night. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Now the word seize, it is a very common word in the Old Testament. This word seize. Let me just give you one of the multitude of cases where it's used. In 2 Kings 4:1, there is a woman whose husband has died. He was one of the sons of the prophets. And she says to Elisha, God's servant, my husband is dead. And he left some bills. And the creditor is going to come and take our two children away. And this is where Elisha multiplies the oil. But the word take is used there. If he cannot find the means to pay the bill, he's going to violently take those children away as an alternative. Job is asking that darkness take away that night, that it seize it, that it take it, that it remove it from the calendar, that it make it disappear, and let that day be wiped out of our calendars. Let there be no joy in it. In verse 7, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. In verse 8, let those curse it who curse the day, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Those people put more stock that they had people like Balaam who were professional cursers. Now, we have professional cursers in a kind of different way in our culture. It's usually not a title given, but it's some are really good at it. But they pronounce, remember it was said about Balaam that whoever he cursed was cursed, and whoever he blessed was blessed in Numbers chapter 22 and verse 6. And Job is calling forth, bring out those that are professionals at pronouncing curses to pronounce a curse on that day. Now, we'll have more to say as we go throughout the book of Job about Leviathan. But Leviathan is, in this passage, I think, a mythical creature, like Psalm 74, verses 13 and 14 say. It's used parallelism. The term Leviathan used parallelism with sea monsters. The Leviathan is pictured as having multiple heads. But the point of this particular passage is Leviathan, usually a bad thing, and God crushes Leviathan underfoot. Here, Leviathan is rising to almost to make waste of this particular day. Leviathan gets more positive mention here. And in verse 5, let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawn breaking. Curse on the day, verses 4 and 5. Curse on the night, in verses 6 through 9. And the reason in verse 10, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. The text actually has my womb instead of my mother's womb. You notice in the New American Standard that mother is in italics, but it is the womb in which Job dwelt, and in that sense was his womb. Maybe there was a day that there was a difficult task that you had to face, or you were facing the consequences of something foolish you'd done, and you wake up in the night and you would be content for the night to continue forever and the morning sun to never rise. If you can relate at all to that, as I've had somebody share with me, if you can relate to that at all, that's the kind of thing Job is saying about the day he was born. Does he expect it to accomplish anything? He knows it can't erase him or his existence or his birth from history. But he is in great pain. And it is interesting to me that Job in verses 1 through 10 really doesn't address anybody. He doesn't address God. He doesn't address his friends. He is just largely venting his frustration. Now, we have a few parallels in Scripture. Elijah prayed a similar idea in 1 Kings 19:4, as it said, "O Lord, take away my life." Jonah prays that in Jonah 4, verse 3. "Take away my life. Death is better to me than life." Both of them were discouraged. Both of them were broken. Now, I will say this. They are broken for different reasons. Elijah is broken in 1 Kings 19 because God's people have not listened to God's prophets. They have torn down God. They've torn down God's altars and they've killed his other prophets. Elijah is discouraged because he has been unsuccessful in changing Israel's hearts. Jonah is discouraged in Jonah 4 verse 3 because he's been successful. Because the people of Nineveh have listened. The people of Nineveh have listened and God has spared them. Jonah wanted God to take their lives. So he's regretting his successfulness. But the most dramatic parallel is in Jeremiah 20. In Jeremiah 20, Jeremiah is charged with being God's prophet, God's spokesman, speaking an unpopular message to a wicked people. Now that is a dangerous combination. And listen to what Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 20, verses 14 through 18. "Cursed be the day when I was born. Let the day not be blessed when my mother bore me. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, saying, 'A baby boy has been born to you,' and made him very happy. But let that man be like the cities which the Lord overthrew without relenting. Let them hear an outcry in the morning and a shout of alarm at noon, because he did not kill me before birth, so that my mother would have been my grave and my womb and her womb ever pregnant. Why did I ever come forth from the womb to look on trouble and sorrow, so that my days have been spent in shame?" Job cursed the day of his birth. Jeremiah cursed the day of his birth. There are different Hebrew words for curse, but they both curse the day of their birth. They do not curse God. Jeremiah doesn't either. He doesn't curse his mother and father. He does curse the one who brought the news to his father. "Curse that one who brought the good news to my father that a child has been born, a baby boy has been born, and may God overthrow him like he overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, because that man should have killed me from birth." Well, obviously, this is hyperbole. He is not saying that the responsibility of that man was really to kill him as soon as he was born. After all, God chose Jeremiah as a prophet from his mother's womb in Jeremiah 1 and verse 5. He's not speaking literally. He is using hyperbole to say in the most dramatic way, like Job is, "I wish I were never born. I wish I were never born." Now, this brings, shows the ultimate lie it is for us to act as if today God just wants us to be happy. These men wish they'd never lived, but their obedience and faithfulness to God have made served as examples to millions since then. Do you have questions there that I didn't answer, or ideas that you would like to express? Bob?
Well, this certainly isn't profound, but every time I've read Job and studied it and even taught it, I hope I didn't warp any of you's understanding of the book when I did that. James 1 just is stuck in my head when we watch this unfold and we ask ourselves, if Job had had that verse, at what point could he have understood what it said? Mm-hmm. And I still think it's at the end of the trial.
Yes.
You know. But we need to remember that.
Okay.
We can't see it. We can't see that blessing in the throes of the trouble, oftentimes. Even though we've been through other trials, everyone's a new day. And we have to relearn that lesson again.
Oh, absolutely.
Which stacks faith upon faith.
And yeah.
So that's just something that always enters my mind when we start reading Job.
Here's the verse Bob mentioned, James 1, 2 through 4. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Now, beautiful passage. A passage that I have had trouble applying in much lesser situations than Job faced. Can you imagine? I'm not asking you to raise your hand here. Can you imagine you speaking words similar to what Job does here, if you had experienced what he had experienced? I could. And I know, and this is a little difficult, this is going to be the thing that makes Job so, so difficult, really. Is because Job obviously said some things he shouldn't. Because he repents at the end of the book. The friends said things they shouldn't because God says they did at the end of the book. But the friends said some things right because they're quoted in the New Testament. What do they say that's right? What do they say that's wrong? I'm not ready, and I recognize not all may agree with this. I'm not ready to say what Job says right here is a sin. I think he keeps some boundaries. He's not cursing God. He's not cursing his parents. He doesn't curse God and die the way the Satan said that he would. Doesn't do that. But he just pours out his frustration about the day he was born. If someone close to us had said these words, if a friend of yours wrote those words in a personal note to you, would you be concerned? Of course. Of course we would. And we would want to get a hold of them quickly to make sure to assure them. But I'm just not convinced yet that he is wrong in saying this. Now, you may disagree, and I can understand that. But there will be points where I won't say that about what Job said. But I do appreciate that verse, as Bob mentions James 1, 2, 3, 4. He might have been even more encouraged, Bob, if he knew the end of the book of James where he gets mentioned as an example of endurance. That would have encouraged him a lot. But well, any other thoughts you have? Any other ideas?
Yeah, I don't mean to say that it's a safe curse, but it is
the safest possible thing to curse? In the idea of it's his beginning. It's not an animal or it's a person or God. So it's hard. I agree with you. It's hard to find a violation other than the venting. But it's a very personal. It doesn't go beyond his beginning, right?
Yeah. And sometimes people will make this statement. I ran across this in several commentaries. That some believed in the ancient world, and I've probably quoted this at some point favorably, but some believe in the ancient world that when a curse was unleashed, that it almost had a power of its own to accomplish its message. I don't think Job thinks that here. I don't think Job thinks this is going to change anything. I don't think he's going to speak these words and all of a sudden he's going to disappear and leave no memory in anybody's mind. I think he just needs to pour out his frustrations. And there will be times that we will need to do that as well. And sometimes it's better doing it by ourselves. Sometimes it's doing it with somebody there listening who's just going to understand and not try to overanalyze.
This would be the wrong time to quote 1 Corinthians 10:13 to Job, wouldn't it?
Well, we know that's true.
Yeah.
We know it's still true, 1 Corinthians 10:13, if someone can hear that. But now, that I struggle with too. Sometimes people say, oh, this was so unkind in the way this was said to Job. Well, it's particularly unkind because it's untrue and inaccurate. Now, there'll be some things that I think we can say, yeah, they crossed that road. It's just flat out unkind. But yeah, that passage is an encouragement. But as one person told me once, whose husband had just kind of died suddenly, and she was left as a widow in her mid-40s, she said, I know that it's true, but the Lord thinks I'm a lot stronger than I think I am. And so I can understand that view too. But after Job curses the day of his birth, he then asked the question in 11 through 19, why did I not die at birth? Now, there's going to be, let me just see if you pick up on it. There's a magical word. I'm not saying that in the sense we usually associate it with good things. There's a word not mentioned here, but it is obviously the picture on which everything is based. Let me just read it and see if you pick it up. Verses 11 through 19. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb, and expire? Why did the knees receive me, and why the breast that I should sup? For now I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have been silent, then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who were filling their houses with silver, or like a miscarriage which is discarded. I would not be as infants that never saw the light. There the wicked cease from raging. There the weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Now, in verse 17 and in verse 19, it uses the term there, and there the weary are at rest. In verse 19, the small and the great are there. Where is there? What's he talking about?
Realm of the dead.
Okay, the realm of the dead or Sheol. Sheol is not used in this passage. It is not used in this passage. But it is obviously the idea in this passage. It will be used in the book of Job, but it's not used in 3:11 through 19. Just notice, be watching for this. Who all is in Sheol in Job's estimation here in 3:11 through 19? Who is there and what is their situation? Be looking for that. In verse 11, why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb, and expire? Job is going to ask that same kind of question in Job 10, verses 18 and 19. Job 10, 18 and 19. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Would that I had died and no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been, carried from the womb to tomb. So in 10, 18, and 19, just like here, why did I ever live to see this? Was the purpose of my birth and my life to simply accumulate all these blessings and be given these good things, to have them taken from me and me to die in pain and agony? I understand his question. If he is a real historical person, as we have claimed that he was, how in the midst of all those losses could that question not come to his mind? Was this the purpose of it all? Was this all my life has been pointing to? And there are places in the Old Testament where you see a father or grandfather receiving a child upon his knees. And there are places you see a mother doing that. And so there's questions among some who write on the book. Are the knees that receive him in verse 12 the knees of a father figure or of a mother figure? But if it is a parallelism that involves both men and women, we would say fathers, because it mentions nursing at the mother's breast in verse 12. If it is meant to be a perfect synonymous parallelism, both of them may reference mothers. But still, why was somebody receiving this child on their knees, naming them, rejoicing over them, if this was the whole purpose of their existence? Now, as you look at these verses, who all does he picture as being in Sheol? Who all does he picture as being in Sheol? Okay, in verse 14, kings, counselors, verse 15, princes. So all the prominent people are here. But who else is included?
Wicked in 17?
Yeah, the wicked. The wicked in 17.
Infants or those that aren't even born.
Okay. Those who come forth from the womb and pass away. They were alive in the womb and they die at birth. They're there in 11 and 12 and verse 16. In verse 17, the wicked. In verse 18, the prisoners. And in verse 19, you have that encompassing mirrorism, the small and the great. So, and you have sometimes people who are just on the bottom end of the social spectrum, like the slave, and the master, but the slave is free from his master in verse 19. Is what this says about there, about Sheol, would you view this as being a more positive statement about Sheol or a negative one? It's more positive. And I will tell you, Job is not always consistent with that picture of Sheol. He's not always consistent. Listen to Job 10, 20, and 21. Before I go, and I shall not return to a land of darkness and deep shadow, to a land of utter gloom as darkness itself, or of deep shadow without order, where in which shines as the darkness. He uses terms to refer to Sheol in 10, 21, and 22 that he wished would have overcome his day of birth in 3, verses 1 through 10. Sheol is a land where darkness is engulfing. It's a land like Egypt where darkness can be felt in Exodus 10, verses 21 through 29, is a land filled with darkness. Job's picture of Sheol is not always consistent. And I don't think that we should use Job 3, verses 11 through 19 to develop some kind of Old Testament concept of Sheol. A matter of fact, in Isaiah 14, remember when the king of Babylon comes down to Sheol, all the other kings gather around the king of Babylon to mock her and ridicule her because she who was so lofty and lifted herself to the heavens has come down to earth. In Ezekiel 32, there is, I call Ezekiel 32, 17 through 32, when the roll is called down yonder. And when they call that roll down yonder, it pictures all those people that will be there, weak and powerless and ineffective. What do we make of the passage? Am I saying, my point is this. Job, in his emotional state, sees death as a preferable situation to life. Throughout the Bible, there's kind of the assumption that life is better than death. A living dog is better than a dead lion, Ecclesiastes 9 says. But here, Job is so filled with pain that it would be a relief that all the troubles and problems of life would cease. I cannot enter into the depth of his sufferings, all that went through his mind, but I want to tell you, I can understand why he said that. Raymond, did you have a thought?
Yes, the idea that to his, in comparison to his current situation, Sheol would be beneficial.
Yes. And it is a place comparatively where he is. Look at some of the place things that happen in Sheol. David, you had a thought. Be looking at that. We'll come back to that. But what was your thought?
We do the same thing. Christian that has battled cancer for years, is suffering, and they pass. They're better off.
And yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So yes,
we
and it
use
is.
That kind of language.
We do. We do. And sometimes inaccurately.
Sometimes.
Maybe I've heard Christians use it even if people who had no respect for God.
I said someone who's a Christian.
You see, I agree. I mean, I know you qualified it. I'm not saying you said that. I'm saying that that sometimes we do.
Tommy?
Yes?
Do you think Job was suicidal?
It does not seem that he entertains that option. And we'll see that. That question, Brenda, goes more with the next section, okay? But I'll try to say just a word about that. In the last couple of years, one time I was stuck in a hotel in a gospel meeting, and it was late a Sunday night, and I stumbled upon something that was trying to give a history of America's early days. And some of the details about good old Aaron Burr were really fascinating. I mean, if you remember him, and it just, wow. You know, we faced some big problems right at first. It pictured, and I don't know, because it, a lot of times when they were talking, there would come up a statement that this was found in a personal letter. This was found in this source. That they were, as much as they could, reconstructing actual words of the characters. But they have a time where George Washington is being raked over the coals in the press, who says, we'd be better to go back to the days the King of England was looking over us. Now, I don't know if that was one of those points where that notification came up and said this was found in this letter of his. I think I could see a person like that in the midst of a lot of problems saying that. Do I think he really meant it? I doubt it. But there are other times, like in this case that we're mentioning, like in some of the cases David mentions, we do mean it. We do understand. Why did I not die at birth? And then the next question, and this is where I said, this is verses 20 through 26. Why is life continued? Why is life continually given to one who is bitter of soul? And this is the section where I said it better fits with the question that Brenda asked. In verse 20, why is life given to him who suffers? Excuse me. Why is light given to him who suffers and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none, and dig for it more than for hidden treasure, who rejoice greatly and exult when they find the grave? Why is light given to the man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? For my groaning comes at the sight of my food, and my cries pour out like water. For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet, and I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. The word turmoil in verse 26, this word has been used three times in the, it was translated trouble in 3:10 in the New American Standard. It's used in 3:20. Why is light given to him who suffers? It's our same word translated trouble in verse 10, suffers in verse 20. In verse 26, turmoil. Same word. We'll come back to that word at the end. Job cursed the day of his birth in 3:1 through 10. In 3:11 through 19, why didn't I die at birth? He pours out those questions. He pours out that frustration. But those are in the past, and that cannot be changed. But Job does have a present, and he wonders, why is life continually given to one who finds life so unbearable? Why is that? But notice, in response to Brenda's question, he doesn't entertain the possibility of taking his life. He doesn't do that here. And one person that I can remember visiting, she was a very godly woman whose husband had died quite a few years before. She was 79 or 80 when this happened, and went to see her in a nursing home and had not seen her in a few years. And since the last time I had seen her, she'd gone blind. Could not see anything from, as I remember, diabetes, but I'm not sure. Even when she was healthy, after her husband died, she told someone close to me that she prayed that the Lord would take her life. And I'm sure after her eyes were gone, after her sight was gone, after she could not basically move much, I'm sure those prayers intensified. I left that day thinking I would never see her again. And I personally did not get to see her. It wasn't in the area close to me, but she lived 14 more years. Why is light given to one who finds life a heavy weight and a difficult burden? And the answer to that is we don't know. We don't know. God has to have a purpose, but it doesn't mean that that purpose is understandable or easy for us to discern. And I think that woman was confident. She was right with God. And I think in such circumstances, I might fear my life being prolonged, lest I blow that. And maybe she was as well. But look at their longing for death. They find life intolerable. They're bitter of soul. And even eating and drinking, verse 24, experiences that generally bring a little joy and a little light into our lives are filled with pain. And nothing tastes good to him. Nothing he drinks is good. The book of Psalms talked about the drinking, the tears being our food. A couple of references to that. Psalm 42 in verse 3, Psalm 80 in verse 5. And notice how death is pictured. That they long for death in verse 21. That word long it is used most often in the Bible for us longing for God. But the object of longing here is death. To my knowledge, this is the only place in the Bible where death is the object of that word. Who long for death, but there's none. Who search for it as for hidden treasure. Some risked their lives and gave up everything and traveled across dangerous regions of America in horses and buggies in the 1840s and 50s to try to find hidden treasure in the gold mines of California, the gold of California. But the Bible tells us here are people who are looking for death like a hidden treasure. Now, one of the things that makes that kind of fascinating is sometimes great treasures were hidden in tombs. And so in a sense, they might dig down looking to find a tomb, particularly if you find a tomb of a pharaoh or something like that, and you find a tomb of a wealthy person and you want to rob those tombs of their silver and gold. But here again, the object of the longing, the object of the digging is death. And in verse 22, death, which generally brings sadness, is bringing rejoicing instead. There is a feeling of relief and even joy as death approaches. And in verse 23, Job does mention God. Why is light given? By the way, all those words are in italics in the New American Standard. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Do you notice the similar language to 110 when the devil said you put a hedge about Job? To the Satan, that hedge in 110 was a protection to Job against all troubles. To Job in 323, that hedge is a straitjacket that is a source of curse and not blessing. You know, God had said about Job, spare his life, 2:6. At this moment, Job would have wished this didn't happen. For what I fear comes upon me. By the way, I heard, and I wasn't too familiar with this. I still am not too familiar with this. So I could be wrong in some of my details of what's happening, though I still want to use this to make a statement about bottom line, whether this is right or wrong. A few years ago, apparently, Canada said that they will begin having physician-assisted suicide for patients who are terminally ill. That's where they said they're starting. That's where they said they were stopping. But today, they give physician-assisted suicide, apparently, and this is where I could be wrong, didn't research this, heard this, to people who are perfectly healthy, people who are young, but people who just don't want to go on with living. Now, I may be incorrect in my details of what all they're doing, but that's not a biblical picture. And we open up sometimes a medical profession where they take an oath that we're going to do good and not harm to taking life instead of healing life. It is a disastrous thing. It's a disastrous thing. Now, I want you to notice. Let's see if I can do a good job stating this. The words in verse 26, I'm not at ease. Job's going to use that term for at ease in 12 verse 6, where he's going to talk about how the wicked are at ease. It's in 12, I said 12, 6, the tense of destroyers, I think it's 12, 6. That's what I have in my notes, okay? 12, 6. Job says about Sheol in verse 17, the weary have rest there, verse 17. But that word rest appears again in verse 26. And Job says, while those in Sheol have rest, I don't have rest. He said that they would have lain down and been quiet in 3:13. But Job says in 3:26, I don't have quiet. The reason Job finds death such an enviable state is because he believes in Sheol they have all those things he doesn't have and he can't find. Now, one of the things, it is hard for me to imagine what it would have been like for Job to experience this enormous loss and now this intense pain where he really gets no relief, not only from the emotional suffering, but from his present state and his present physical state. And he's also going to find that even those closest to him have turned against him. He really faced things that are incredible. And when I criticize him throughout the book, I'm not claiming to have done better. Now, or that I would do better. Each of us, though, will probably have some kind of experience like this. If not before death, at that time. And may we learn something from God's nature from this book. Raymond, did you have a thought just a second ago?
Yeah, just back to what you were saying about the assistance in death. I had actually printed off an article today about it. And you're right, you could walk off the street, a healthy individual, and claim depression. And you would fill the criteria to apply for medical assistance in death, and the acronym is MAID, a play on word for a woman that would come in and clean your room. So that is a real thing that you're talking about.
Okay. It's sad. It is sad. Anybody else have a thought there? Or this is a deeply emotional chapter.
Yeah, about the suicide question.
Yeah.
It appears Job is only asking why in his venting.
Yeah.
But he doesn't ever, for his faith in God, he understands from where the life comes from. I think,
yes.
I think maybe he's steadfast in the respect of the life giver. Venting about why.
Yeah.
I definitely relate to, but I think he's a respecter of life.
Yes, yes, he definitely seems to be. Now, appreciate that. Appreciate all your thoughts and questions. And I know we had a lot, and we've gone over, and I apologize for that. I suggested to the neighbors we be out by 8:30. So, I'm pressing it. But I want to point out a few things, kind of along the lines of what we did in Psalms. Job 3:1, Job opened his mouth and curse the day of his birth. Open and mouth are two words used in Isaiah 53, verse 7, of the servant. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, but he did not open his mouth. Jesus endured this kind of suffering with no protest. The word trouble that I mentioned in 3:10, that's also used in 3:20 and 3:26, it is used in Isaiah 53, verse 11. When it says of the suffering servant, as a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it, God will see it, and be satisfied. It's Isaiah 53, verse 11. That word anguish is the same word trouble used in Job 3:10. It's also used in Job 3:20 and Job 3:26. I said earlier, no one walked through the valley of the shadow of death like Job. I was exempting there Jesus. But Jesus did. In 3:18, when the Bible tells us the prisoners are at ease together and they do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. Okay. One of those words, I need to look back at this, because one of those words is used in Isaiah 53, verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. The point is, the same kind of language that applies to Job's sufferings applied to Jesus' sufferings. Is it fair for God to let this happen, Job? God sent his son to go through the same kind of suffering so that we could be saved. All things look different in light of the cross. There's a passage that, to my knowledge, I have never heard used in a Lord's Supper talk before services, that has kind of astonished me. In Luke 12, 49 and 50, Jesus said, I have a baptism with which I'm baptized, and how I am pained until it is accomplished. He longed for it to be over. He longed for it to be past. He longed for it to be history. Luke 12, 49 and 50, I have a baptism that I have to accomplish, and how I wish it were already accomplished. I didn't quote it precisely, but you can look it up and see the words. In a sense, at those moments, from just a personal level, Jesus, who unlike us, made a decision to enter our world, it was almost as if he wished. He was never born to have to undergo what he went through, but he did it for us. That thought is truly overwhelming to me. Okay. As we close, Craig, would you lead us in prayer?
Our God and Father, our Creator, we praise your name, Lord. We thank you for giving each of us life and breath, Lord, we can understand at times a fraction of the difficulty of Job, but let us never forget that you are with us every step. You are with us when blessings abound and things are very pleasant, but you are just as close when things are difficult and trials come. And we're thankful to have that assurance, that comfort, if we would only look to you. Thank you so much for this time together in study. Thank you for the lessons that we can gather from your word, the wisdom and the power that is contained in it. And we're thankful that we can have opportunities like this to meet with others, to study together and draw strength and encouragement from your word and from each other. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you all for listening in line. We will not have class next week. I'm supposed to be in a meeting, so we will not have class next week. And tell all of you that here, Lord willing, our next class will be on September 2nd, September 16th. September 16th, Lord willing. Thank you for listening online. Thank you and God bless.